It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at the law and politics behind President Obama's coming announcement this evening that he will block the deportation of millions of immigrants who are in the country illegally.
First, the Human Rights Campaign last week released a report measuring LGBT equality in over 350 American cities. Wisconsin scored above the national average for how some of its cities treat LGBT people.
The group's 2014 Municipal Equality Index is the only nationwide index that measures lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender inclusion in municipal law and policy. This year, four Wisconsin cities were part of that study. Their scores together averaged 76 out of 100. That's higher than the national average of 59. With us now is Catherine Oakley, Legislative Counsel for State and Municipal Advocacy at the Human Rights Campaign. She's principal author of this Municipal Equality Index. Catherine, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you were lead author of this study. Why measure LGBT equality at the city level?
Well, of course, we've seen a lot of progress in the courts, the federal courts nationwide over the last several months and years. But, you know, in terms of legislating, and particularly in the areas of non-discrimination at the state level, we have not seen that same level of progress, which means that people are subject to all kinds of discrimination, including being fired from their jobs, being denied housing, and also, you know, being denied access to public accommodations just because of who they are. And of course, anti-LGBT discrimination goes far beyond that. And one of the things that the MEI really looks at, the Municipal Equality Index looks at in depth, is all of the different ways that cities can make sure that they are being inclusive of the LGBT community in terms of non-discrimination laws and also including making sure that they're being inclusive as they're providing city services.
So when you're scoring cities, what kind of things did you include? What kind of things did you measure?
Well, we have 47 different criteria that fall into six major categories. The first category is non-discrimination laws. So in Wisconsin, of course, there's a non-discrimination law at the state level that includes sexual orientation, but it does not include discrimination on the basis of gender identity. And two of the cities in Wisconsin that did very well, Madison and Milwaukee, they both have non-discrimination laws that go further than the state law that include discrimination on the basis of gender identity. And so those cities scored very well partially because of that in this non-discrimination section. We also look at relationship recognition. We look at how the city treats its own employees in terms of what kind of non-discrimination policies and what kinds of benefits it offers to city employees. We look at city services and also law enforcement. And finally, we look at how active the city has been on matters of LGBT equality.
Now, the four Wisconsin cities that were in the study were Green Bay, Kenosha, Madison, and Milwaukee. Do you just have a population cutoff, or how are cities chosen for the study?
Yeah, we rated 353 cities this year, and that is the 50 state capitals, the 200 largest cities in the country, the four largest cities in every state, the city that is home to the state's largest public university, and also 75 cities that are large, medium, and small size that are home to high proportions of same-sex couples.
Now, before we dig into the specific results in the Wisconsin cities, big picture, did you see trends? I believe this is the third year you've done this study?
Yes, this is the third year that we've done it. And yes, we definitely did see trends. One of the things that has been so striking every single year that we have done this project is that we've seen how much cities really truly are leading the way when it comes to matters of equality. It's amazing to see how many cities are really stepping forward and doing more for their LGBT citizens than their state legislatures are. And so that's definitely something that we saw again this year. We had 38 perfect scores of 100 points, and 15 of those perfect scores came from cities that are in states that had neither marriage equality nor non-discrimination laws at the state level. So those cities earned every single point on their own and made sure that all 100 points of opportunity were taken by them.
Well, let's look at the four Wisconsin cities you evaluated, and just if you can share some of the main points of the findings, and we'll just go biggest to smallest. Let's start with Milwaukee.
Yeah, so Milwaukee scored 91 points, so it was a very good score. And as I mentioned, one of the things that really set Milwaukee apart was that it does have this non-discrimination ordinance that includes gender identity, meaning that, you know, when you're within the boundaries of Milwaukee, that you are you have to make sure that you're not discriminating against people on the basis of gender identity, which is further than state law. So that's really significant. One of the other things that ended up happening late in the game this research year was, of course, marriage equality came to Wisconsin. So all of the cities that we rated in Wisconsin ended up getting points for marriage equality. Those cities were able to earn those points. Cities don't have any power over marriage equality, of course, but they can offer domestic partner registries, and that's something that Milwaukee had actually already been earning credit for. And so marriage equality did not affect Milwaukee's score.
Then Madison, it would have made your list many times over. Second biggest city, largest public university in the state, and the state capital. Where did Madison fall in the evaluation?
Madison scored a perfect 100 points.
So what? So every criteria you had, Madison met?
Well, sort of. We have 100 standard points and also 20 bonus points. And the bonus points, I hasten to add, are not because those things aren't important. When we're doing an evaluation of cities that are as big as New York City and as small as Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, which has 1,200 people, we have to have some flexibility in the scorecard. And so there are some things that we have in bonus points. So the way it actually worked out for Madison was that Madison received 87 of our 100 standard points, but then they received 18 of the bonus points, which is pretty much almost all of the bonus points. So they came in with a total score of 100 points.
And then Green Bay.
Yeah, so Green Bay did pretty well. It came in at a 54, so it was not the highest. It was, in fact, the lowest in the state. However, I do hasten to add that the national average here was a 59. So Green Bay is very much sort of in the mix nationwide.
And then Kenosha was the fourth city you looked at.
Yeah, very similarly, Kenosha came in at 58 points. So it was right there around the national average. It wasn't knocking anybody's socks off, but it was also a perfectly respectable score.
So what are you hoping that people say in city government or people in communities in cities, whether they were in your evaluation or not, what are you hoping they take with these results and do with them?
Well, you know, as I said, one of the things that's really important here is that I think it's really important to acknowledge that cities really are leading the way on matters of equality, and that their reasons for doing so are really important, and something that I hope that state legislatures pay attention to say, look, you know, cities are grappling with all of the same competing priorities that we are, and this is something that they're making a priority for really important reasons, and we should too. But perhaps even more importantly and more directly for the cities, I think if you get a scorecard that's anything less than 100 points, that the way to look at the scorecard is to say, this is putting together a to-do list. Circle all of the zeros and make that our priority for the next couple years to really get that score up there. And, you know, we can talk about scores. It's nice to have a quantitative something to look at. And I think that's something, and it certainly helps people understand where they are in relation to other places. But ultimately, this isn't about the points. It's about making sure that cities are really being inclusive of the people who live and work where they are.
We'll leave it there. Catherine, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to do it.
That was Catherine Oakley, Legislative Counsel for State and Municipal Advocacy at the Human Rights Campaign. She's the principal author of the report we've been talking about, the Municipal Equality Index. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll look at the politics and legality of President Obama's action on immigration expected to come this evening.
First, history is on the move as a Wisconsin Historical Society traveling exhibit is making its way through the state, teaching people about genealogy, shipwrecks, and life on the farm. Maureen McCollum has more on the Wisconsin History Tour's month-long stop in La Crosse.
The Dousmans were the lone socialites of Prairie du Chien in the late 1800s, living off the enormous fur trade and real estate wealth made by their father. So when people would travel from St. Paul in Milwaukee to their home, the Villa Louis, the Dousmans made the trip worth it for their guests.
And Frederick Bigelow that week comments that he gained 7¾ pounds net that week. That was a sign that Mrs. Dousman and Mrs. Johnson were taking very good care of her guests.
Susan Caius-Lucer is the site manager at the Villa Louis, the first site acquired by the Wisconsin Historical Society. Today, she's teaching a room full of people about a typical Victorian breakfast served at the mansion. It's part of a traveling Wisconsin Historical Society exhibit that immerses itself in a new city each month. Kaya Slusser says with the Wisconsin Historical Society's offices and museums in Madison and historic sites scattered across the state, the tour brings history to the people. She says it's a reminder of what the society has to offer.
You know, the genealogy, our photography collection, the other sites in our system. There's some wonderful sites. Reed School is just north of us. There's Madeline Island. So it just offers an opportunity for people to kind of get to know our agency better.
And today, Kaya Slusser has brought the food of the late 1800s to La Crosse. She serves guests a green tomato relish known as pickalilly, a side the Dousman family would have used to spruce up beef or pork in the winter. Ruth Amundson of Westby puts some pickalilly on a cracker and takes a bite. She's able to taste the flavors that the Dousmans did, immersing herself in history.
It's pungent.
Oh, it's rather
good.
Kind of
like you had taken a jar of good relish and put a little sauerkraut, put some sugar. It's sweet. Try some.
Amundson is a self-described history buff and a Wisconsin Historical Society member. She's attended many of the week's presentations.
It's history alive. And I think so often we in high school, just a bunch of dead people and dates. Well, it's not. An old phrase is, you don't know where you're going unless you know where you've come from, right?
Mm-hmm. Wisconsin History Tour coordinator Mary Jane Connor agrees. In bringing the exhibit to different communities, she says it helps people contemplate their place in history and learn from past mistakes.
It helps us live better lives to know our history and see what's done well and see what's done poorly. And without it, you know, we would never know what we're doing. Everything would be a guess.
Every Wisconsin History Tour stop has exhibits on Native Americans, inventions, and the state's 750 shipwrecks. But organizers also work with the local historical societies to create displays unique to the community. In La Crosse, there's a focus on the region's historic women, featuring members of the Ho-Chunk Nation and Ellen Hickson, who helped save the renowned Granddad Bluff in La Crosse in the early 1900s. The Wisconsin History Tour will be in La Crosse through November. From there, it moves on to Milwaukee, Green Bay, Appleton, and Eau Claire. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
Tonight, President Obama will deliver a speech in which he's expected to formally announce his executive order to halt the deportation of millions of immigrants in the country illegally.
Details about the president's action began to emerge last week. The exact number of immigrants being shielded from deportation remains to be seen. It's likely to be around 5 million people. Those without criminal records would be able to apply to work legally in the country and not be deported.
Immigration has been a contentious topic in Washington, and the divided legislature hasn't been able to agree on any reform during the past 6 years. President Obama says congressional inaction is leading him to take matters into his own hands with an executive action.
Republicans have called the president's actions illegal, say they will move to bar the order from taking effect however they can. Here to talk about the politics and some of the legality behind the president's expected action is Ken Mayer. He's a political science professor at UW-Madison, specializing in presidential powers. Ken, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So at issue is can the president really do this? So what is an executive action? How much latitude does a president have?
It's a difficult question to answer because the answer is not clear. The president can do via executive action anything that he can validly do through the exercise of constitutional or statutory powers. The problem is that the boundaries of those powers are often unclear. And so ultimately, I think the fallout from this is more likely to be political than legal.
And there's been a lot of pushback back and forth for this, not just in the Obama administration, but for decades. It seems like what is the purpose of executive action? Is it usually in a case like this where the president says Congress should be doing this? They're not, so I'm gonna? Or are there usually different reasons given?
Well, acting in the face of congressional inaction is one reason you see it. More often you see it whenever the president sees an opportunity to implement his policy preferences. And this actually goes all the way back to George Washington, who got into trouble with his neutrality proclamation in 1793. Almost every president, and certainly every president who's done anything significant, has made use of executive orders or the full range of actions or unilateral presidential action.
So in this case, one of the arguments we've been hearing in favor of what the president is apparently going to do is When it comes to law enforcement at the federal level, you're going to be able to do some things and not other things, given limited resources. This is a matter of reprioritizing how we use the resources. Therefore, the argument goes, this is perfectly within the president's rights. Is there merit to that kind of argument?
There is some. There are other arguments that probably are a little more applicable. One of them is the use of prosecutorial discretion, that it is longstanding principle that it is an executive presidential power almost exclusively to decide the circumstances and conditions under which the laws will be, people will be prosecuted for law violations. And that's something that virtually nobody else, neither Congress nor the courts, can compel the president to prosecute when the president does not wish to. And that's the basis of this order. It's a temporary reprieve that signals to the people to whom the order applies that if they meet the conditions, that the executive branch will not initiate deportation proceedings. But it's not permanent. It could certainly be revoked by a subsequent president. But one of the reasons we're seeing controversy is that this takes place in the context of an ongoing battle between Congress and the president over control of policy.
Now, as you say, this is temporary. This isn't an amnesty, a full-on amnesty, saying, hey, as of now, you're cool. Even if you're here illegally, you can get a green card. You can start moving towards citizenship.
More or less, that's correct. Now, certainly the president conceivably does have that kind of authority by issuing a prospective pardon, but that's not what we're talking about here. This is a temporary reprieve against deportation.
Now, let's get to the reaction, mainly the reaction from Republicans in Congress. Mitch McConnell saying, hey, we're going to do something. We're not quite sure what yet, but his colleagues throughout Congress are laying out all sorts of alternatives. What is the range of reactions available to Congress?
Well, Congress can do any one of a number of things, ranging from refusing to take action on some other priority that the president has. Ted Cruz of Texas has suggested that the Senate refuse to confirm any more presidential nominees. There are other suggestions of taking legal action, initiating litigation, tinkering with budget requests, all the way up to shutting the government down through refusing to pass appropriations. And there are some Republicans who are even talking about impeachment.
Do you think it's going to come that far? We'll go to the brink of another fiscal cliff type shutdown of a serious movement toward impeachment?
Unlikely, but possible. One of the issues is that this is for the Republicans in Congress. They are facing issues with the leadership and the more conservative Tea Party wing of the party. And it's not always clear that the party leadership in Congress has the ability to control what the various members of the caucus will do. So I imagine there will be some ongoing discussion and controversy within the Republican Party about what the appropriate action should be.
Well, you mentioned possible stalling on nominees. The country's going to need a new attorney general. Maybe in this lame duck Congress, though it's looking like it'll be the new all-Republican-led Congress. Do you see that as a potential forum, arena for debate, for questioning of this decision?
Sure. And in the course of hearings that the Senate Judiciary Committee will call, that's one of the issues that I'm quite confident they will question the nominee about. And all of this comes down to the fact that this is largely a political controversy, a political dispute. It is very unlikely, in my view, and I've been looking at the range of opinions that constitutional scholars have been writing, that it's almost impossible to imagine a court stepping in and telling the president that he can't do this or ordering the president to begin to suspend the policy.
Well, as a political issue, a big question is why now? Why didn't this happen either before Election Day or after a new Congress was confirmed?
Well, I think the explanation is, had the president done this a few months before the midterms, where he got hammered in any event, it would have been worse because it would have galvanized more opposition during midterm elections. It's been well established that people who are angry and unhappy are much more likely to turn out, and that was happening in any event. But had Obama taken this action before that, it would have been, I think, worse. I think one of the reasons he is taking the action is that he laid down this marker a while ago saying that he was going to take action and faced pressure from within the Democratic base, the Democratic constituency that was putting pressure on him.
Well, looking to future politics, this will rally the Republican base looking ahead to 2016. But is there a payoff for Democrats rallying people who are in favor of immigration reform?
Well, it's not clear. I think this certainly will connect the Democrats with Latinos, which is an important constituency. But there have been efforts by the Republicans to do something to try to improve their position among Latinos. And this will become part of that. But I think it's a little early to think about the implications of this for the 2016 election.
We're speaking with Ken Mayer. He is a political science professor here at UW-Madison. We're talking about President Obama's announcement that's expected this evening that he's going to block deportation of millions of undocumented immigrants.
And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What do you think of the president's expected executive action on immigration? Is he getting things done where Congress hasn't, or is he overreaching? And what do you expect to see in the political fallout? Call 800-642-1234, or you can also post your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up, we'll get into what we're hearing from some states, including Texas's governor, on this issue, and talk about what this might foretell about the potential for compromise and cooperation between the president and a Republican Congress. Stick around. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with Ken Mayer, political science professor at UW-Madison. He specializes in presidential powers. We're talking about President Obama's coming announcement this evening that he'll block the deportations of an expected 5 million immigrants in the country illegally. He says he's taking action because Congress hasn't acted on its own to reform immigration. Republicans say he's breaking the law.
We'd like to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Should President Obama take this executive action? If you support immigration reform, do you think it should come from the president or from Congress? Or do you think the president's actions go too far or even illegal? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Tony on the line in Madison. Tony, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Oh, what do you think, Tony?
Well, I think that it's the right call. I don't understand what Congress expected with their inability to pass just about anything. You know, I feel like they've lost the ability to compromise, and without compromise, we can't get any sort of legislation through. So the president has done exactly what he said he was going to do. You didn't get the job done. I'm going to move forward. And at least it's some sort of progress. I'm not sure if it's exactly the right sort of progress, but we're at least moving forward.
Tony, thanks a lot for the call. So Congress didn't get the job done, so the president has to. But that argument, how far does that take us, Ken?
Well, I'll give you an analogy. In 1942, during World War II, Franklin Roosevelt wanted Congress to change the agricultural price support policy. He said it was necessary for the war effort. And he told Congress that I'm going to give you 30 days to pass the legislation. And if you don't, I'm going to act as if you had. And really, basically, in the words of Robert Taft, the Senate Minority Leader, said that he had put a gun to the head of Congress. As a political matter, that argument, I think, carries some traction. As a legal and constitutional one, I think it's a little bit less persuasive, because the fact that Congress won't do what the president wants is not by itself sufficient justification for the president to go ahead and do it anyhow. It has to be based more on valid constitutional authorities. But again, this is part of the political discussion that's taking place in the context of this action, which I think are ultimately going to be more important than the constitutional issues, which I think are a little bit clearer but not quite as persuasive to people.
On the staying on the political side, there was some thought that with an all-Republican Congress, you might have a unified front there and a negotiating partner in the president, and there might be room for the two sides to find compromise and cooperation here and there where they could. Is this a signal from the president that, no, I'm not really interested in playing that way?
Well, it depends on what perspective you're coming from. In the wake of the midterms, there were some indications from both the Democrats and Republicans that they hoped that they could work in a bipartisan manner. I don't think anybody really took it all that seriously, and it certainly didn't take much to render those initial promises inoperative, as one says in Washington.
We'll go back to our callers now with Jody in Menominee. Jody, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm mixed on whether he should be doing it, but in terms of what is happening, I am totally in support of this. I've worked with immigrants that are working on the factory farms in this area, and the owners are Republicans that would be against this. But the reality is, and all the Republican representatives know this, they are all undocumented workers. And it's this unspoken lie that everyone is pretending doesn't exist. And without those hardworking people, those farms would not be able to exist. And I'm tired of them working, you know, living off the backs of these hardworking people. And I know a lot of them personally, that really are honest, working, you know, 60 hours a week and happy to do that. And I'm tired of that and them not being willing to you know, name it for what it is.
Jody, thanks a lot for the call. Ken, is there unanimity among Republicans on this issue? Is there a business side that says, hey, we kind of need this labor, we need to reform things, versus the maybe Tea Party wing?
I think that's probably right. There is certainly among many Republicans an insistence that if the law is being violated, that those violations must be mm-hmm. prosecuted. But there are pockets within the Republican Party, some business interests in the agriculture, hospitality industries, that they're not quite as vociferous, in part because they, in some places, they do rely on relatively inexpensive sources of labor. And I think this is another example of a possible intramural conflict within the Republican Party between the leadership and the conservatives and maybe some business interests who might be more supportive of something like this that the president is doing. And right now, what we're hearing from is is opposition to what the president is doing. And obviously, as often happens in these situations, we're hearing from the people who are squawking the loudest. But over time, I think the precise contours of the opposition and the possible complexity of this will become a little clearer.
One other wrinkle, Rick Perry, Republican governor of Texas, says the state is considering suing President Obama if he goes through with this. Is that something states can do to challenge executive action?
Well, they certainly can. One of the requirements that you need to show in order to get a hearing in federal court is you have to show standing. You have to show that you are explicitly harmed by the action. And from the standpoint of the states, the argument, I imagine, would be something to the effect that by granting these people limited legal status, that is likely to pose a burden on states in terms of welfare, health care, and various forms of social services. And that will be the question of standing that gets them into the court, whether or not the states have the authority to challenge the president, particularly when we're talking about prosecutorial discretion, is much more difficult. There was a previous dispute on immigration when Arizona sued the federal government, or maybe the federal government sued Arizona over Arizona's fairly strict immigration laws. And the Supreme Court was actually fairly sympathetic to the president, noting the wide latitude that immigration law and these constitutional principles give to the president. So they can certainly try. Whether they succeed, that's a much tougher burden for the states to bear.
Back to our callers now with Jamie in Fond du Lac. Jamie, hi.
First, I wanted to say that I am disappointed that the House is not actually going to be voting on this. I really think that that's the best way that it should be addressed, and I think that that's the way that we could actually have a permanent fix. But without that, from my understanding, the president, as being the head of the executive branch, has the ability to say what laws will be enforced and in which way, just like he has put a stop to enforcing marijuana laws in the states where they have legalized this.
Jamie, thanks for the call. I mean, at some point, though, doesn't the president go to a point where he's coming into conflict with laws previously passed by Congress, Ken?
That's true. There are a couple of constitutional principles and provisions that are conflicting here. One of them is the president's plenary authority under prosecutorial discretion to decide what are the circumstances and how the Justice Department, how federal agents, prosecutors will prosecute violations of the law. And that's a well-recognized principle. There are other principles. The president has a constitutional duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. The president does not have the authority to nullify a law. The president couldn't stand up and say, I'm simply going to ignore this and pretend that this law had never been passed. There is no definitive answer to where the precise boundaries are when a proper exercise of power turns into an improper exercise of power. And this is a debate that has been going on. It went on at the Constitutional Convention. It's been going on since the administration of George Washington. We don't know what the boundaries are. There are arguments and authorities that one can cite on both sides. So it's not an easy question that has clear, definitive, authoritative answers.
Well, whether we're talking about immigration or another issue, do you think we're going to see more conflicts like this in the next 2 years with President Obama and Republican Senate and Congress and maybe future divided government situations?
Well, I think the long-term fallout is likely to be that whenever the president pushes the envelope of executive powers, and the fact that in this case, I think Obama is pushing the envelope a little bit, perhaps not to the point where he's bursting through them, but what that will do is set a precedent that a future president might rely on in making his or her own determination. And so you can see the arguments floating around. So some people are suggesting that a Republican president in the future may simply decide that as a matter of prosecutorial discretion, they're not going to initiate action against people who refuse to pay their estate tax. And so this all takes place in the context of this ongoing dispute that is ultimately going to be resolved politically, I think, rather than legally.
Ken, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Ken Mayer. He's political science professor at UW-Madison, talking about President Obama's announcement coming this evening on immigration. And you can listen to that speech along with analysis tonight at 7 here on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll look at a proposal that could have voters around the Milwaukee area sounding off on public arts funding.
First, Thanksgiving is 1 week off, and our next guest has some timely music to share for the occasion and for the season.
Stephanie Elkins is back with us. She's a music host here at WPR. You can hear her on Morning Classics weekday mornings on our NPR News and Classical Music Network and on Simply Folk Sundays from 5 to 8 p.m. on both WPR networks. Stephanie, good to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So this Sunday on Simply Folk, you're going to be featuring songs of gratitude for Thanksgiving. Is this a common theme in folk music?
It is. It's a really common theme, and there are so many wonderful pieces to choose from. And we have them in a whole range. There are funny ones, you know, prayers about let me not drink too much and let all the relatives get along and that kind of thing. And then there are some really meaningful, deep, beautifully written songs. And I was always surprised at how many instrumentals there are of songwriters or musicians expressing gratitude strictly through instrumental music.
Well, tell us about your first one, Tim Harrison. It's Song of Thanksgiving. Give us a feel for it before we give a listen.
Well, he's a Canadian, and it's a song that sort of evokes the cold and the dark that comes this time of year. I mean, look where we are right now. It's dark, and it's freezing this morning. And he talks about entering this time of darkness and cold with gratitude for the resources to get through it, to make it through the dark days.
When the northern wind blows in and the earth tips from the sun, when the harvest is complete and all the work is done, then we know we'll feel the chill, and we know the snow will fall till the woods are filled. And then,
so that one hits pretty close to home right about now. The dark skies, the cold. I don't know about the work being done, but a lot of it, harvest time is done now.
Right. And the line is, and then we'll make time for Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And it is a kind of a time to slow down a little bit. So everybody kind of hunkers down, and it's a time to spend with loved ones and friends and maybe in front of the hearth if you have a fireplace and that kind of thing. But just feel that gratitude. It kind of helps to counterbalance what we have to deal with.
I'll say I have moments like that, lying in my bed, cold night, winds howling, and I'm really thankful that there's something between me and that right now. And I don't wait for Thanksgiving to thank that, especially this year.
Yeah, how many of these are tied to the natural world like that? Not just simply, you know, we're thankful because it's the holiday of Thanksgiving, but because there's a natural cycle going on.
Oh, there, absolutely. I was listening to one a little earlier this week by Susan Werner. It's an ode to Aldo Leopold, and it talks about the land always giving and always providing and the cycles of that kind of bounty where we have this. It's so much of our whole society has been based on this natural cycle over the last, 30,000 years or something like that. So it's very much informs folk music.
Let's check out another piece of music you're sharing with us. This is Sarah Watkins' Take Up Your Spade.
And Sarah Watkins, a former member of Nickel Creek, or continuing member as well?
Yeah, they came together again this past year for a tour. So on again, off again, mm-hmm. I would say. But she started really young, and she's a fiddle player, also other instruments. But she's really got a beautiful feel, beautiful spirit to so many of her songs. And this is one that talks about forgiving and being forgiven. And it comes all to a head with break ground, you know, take up your spade. And that if we make the effort on our parts, then all of this good stuff can happen. There's a lot of hope for the future.
Gratitude and some reconciliation themes mm-hmm. in there too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And she talks about giving thanks for every moment and every crumb. And, you know, sort of there's a sense there of kind of being in the moment and acknowledging the gifts that we have.
Well, that's a lovely one. And well, here's a classic. You were talking earlier about expressing gratitude without words, and it can be done. Jay Unger and Molly Mason, for example, have done it. And they are a pair who have been really good at evoking feelings and moods with simply through music. And we've got one here called Autumn. This is a Thanksgiving hymn.
So tell us about this one.
This is, they simply wanted to express gratitude for the Earth's bounty through music. And they did this as a project. They wrote a whole suite called the Harvest Home Suite. And there's spring and summer and autumn and fall. And for autumn, they chose this harvest hymn, this Thanksgiving hymn. And they did the project with the Nashville Chamber Orchestra. And so it builds into this beautiful crescendo with the orchestra and just this warm feeling. And Veronica, you said earlier that they really are good at evoking feeling. They are the ones that did Ashokan Farewell that mm-hmm. was used during Ken Burns' Civil War series and became very, very popular because it's such an evocative piece of music. It makes us feel something.
We'll have another track from them at the end of the segment, but tell us a little bit about the Thanksgiving waltz we'll hear in a few minutes. You like the waltz idea for this feel.
Oh, I do. And it you can hear a little bit of the Gather Together hymn, you know, the Thanksgiving hymn in there. And they do it in three, and there's something very comforting about music that's in 3/4 time. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. It just makes you, feel warm somehow.
That's a good thought. I never thought about the waltz time like that, but you're right, isn't it? Kind of a rocking.
Yeah, that's a good way to think of it. Yeah.
Well, you've got another one for us here, a Thanksgiving song from Mary Chapin Carpenter. What can you tell us about this one?
Well, she's got a beautiful, rich, deep alto voice, and she's been a very strong singer-songwriter for a long time, crossover sort of country and folk. And this one just goes right to the heart of what the day is about. And she talks about father and mother and friends and people that don't have friends and being able to hold hands and touch and stay connected.
Grateful for each hand we hold, gathered round this table. From far and near we travel home, blessed that we are able.
So do you envision listening to these on Thanksgiving? Because a lot of times families will have a tradition of talking about what they're thankful for around the Thanksgiving table. This is a song that captures a lot of the kind of sentiments you might hear at that moment.
Yeah, absolutely. We did a Thanksgiving show last year on Simply Folk, and there'll be another one this Sunday evening. And I heard from a listener last year that replayed that during Thanksgiving dinner so that they could have the music along with dinner. So it is nice. It's nice to be able to express that through music.
And what will you be listening to, Stephanie? You who's got so much music at your fingertips, what evokes Thanksgiving to you?
Well, I'll be here for the first 3 hours of Thanksgiving, so I'll be sharing a lot of classical music, but I have scheduled some of that Harvest Home Suite by Jay Unger and Molly Mason. And I think there's a lot of... there are a lot of classical pieces and some of the hymns and some of the cantatas of Bach and so forth. I really like a wide range. But, you know, it doesn't have to expressly say Thanksgiving in it. There's a lot of music that that you can say thank you with or feel that without having to have the words overtly written.
And do you sing on Thanksgiving? I know you're a big singer. Too, yeah. Do you, is part of your Thanksgiving celebration, a sing-along?
It often is, yeah. I'll be with friends and family in the evening, and inevitably the guitars come out, and sometimes we even get into Christmas songs and holiday songs. And when you get people together and there's been good food and good wine and, you know, things just go to music for us anyway.
Well, there's one more that you're sharing with us, a lighter-hearted one, this one, I think, and from Wisconsin, right?
That's right. Clay Reines is a singer-songwriter, also quite a talented photographer from Coon Valley near La Crosse, and he is revered by songwriters around the country, and we're lucky to have him here, but he wrote one called The Thanksgiving Ache. It's wonderful, and it talks about, oh, just one more helping. I'll just wait an hour, and then I'll start over again.
Stuff the turkey and baste it with care. This is my favorite bill of fare. Keep your lobster and your snails and your steak, but give me the Thanksgiving egg. Three bean salad and some pickles.
I think we're all familiar with the Thanksgiving ache from the turkey, and he goes on to describe all the other components that leave us lying bloated on the couch watching the football game.
Such a lovely picture, Rob.
I know. I'll send in a picture, put it on Facebook after this Thanksgiving, maybe.
Yeah, there's one line in this song that I just love, which is, keep the cranberries, they do not belong. Anything that turns my turkey purple is wrong.
Well, Stephanie, thanks as always for joining us. Always a lot of fun to talk to you.
Thank you so much for sharing this music.
Stephanie Elkins, host of Morning Classics and Simply Folk on Wisconsin Public Radio.
This Sunday from 5 to 8, you can catch Stephanie's Simply Folk holiday special. She's going to be sharing more songs of Thanksgiving and gratitude.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We go to the news with Thanksgiving Waltz by Jay Unger and Molly Mason. This is Central Time.